Welcome to Audiobook Break from Audiophile Magazine. This season, we're featuring the Japanese-American Civil Liberties Collection from LA Theater Works. Today, in our final episode of the season, we're featuring a post-play discussion with actor George Takei, playwright Philip Khan Gotanda, and director Tim Dang.
I'm Susan Lowenberg, producing director of LA Theater Works. Let's meet our panelists. First, our director. For 23 years, he was producing artistic director of East-West Players, the longest-running professional theater of color in the United States, located here in Los Angeles. He's currently an adjunct lecturer in directing at the USC School of Dramatic Arts. Let's welcome Tim Dang. Next is our distinguished playwright. For the past four decades, he's been a major influence in broadening our definition of theater in America, specializing in investigating the Japanese-American family. He's also a respected independent filmmaker with three works presented at the Sundance Film Festival. Let's welcome the author of Sisters Matsumoto, Philip Khan Gotanda. And our next special guest speaker has a six-decade acting career. He's guided the Starship Enterprise, where no one has gone before. Mashable.com ranked him the number one most influential person on Facebook with over 10 million likes. He's lived a remarkable life, from a childhood spent wrongfully imprisoned in Japanese-American internment camps to becoming one of the leading figures in the fight for social justice. We're honored to introduce George Takei. George, I'd like to start with you. You are a living witness to a dark chapter in American history. Looking back on your time as a child in the camps, can you describe what life was like?
Well, first of all, I'd like to thank both Philip and Tim for such a wonderful, profoundly moving experience you gave us this afternoon. It is a beautiful, beautiful production. And for me personally, it's the first time that I was able to identify with the people and the events and some of the subjects that they talked about. The very first time I was able to, as my own life experience, identify with the events happening. It was, for me, very moving. And thank you to the enormously talented actors, each in their own way, brought these people that I know to reality. I was 5 years old when we were imprisoned. We were here in Los Angeles and taken to the swamps of southeastern Arkansas, to the camp called Roar, which was the camp that the family on stage was in. I remember the soldiers coming to order us out of our home. I remember the long train trip across two-thirds of the country to the swamps of Arkansas, and I remember the barbed wire fence and the sentry towers and the searchlight that followed me when I made the night runs to the latrine. But children are amazingly adaptable. What would have been grotesquely abnormal in normal times became my routine, my normality behind those barbed wire fences, lining up three times a day to eat lousy food in a noisy mess hall, going with my father and my brother to bathe in that raw, cold shower, and to go to school in a black tar paper barrack and begin the school day with a Pledge of Allegiance to the flag. I could see the barbed wire fence and the sentry tower right outside my schoolhouse window, as I recited the words, "With liberty and justice for all." Too young to really understand or feel the stinging irony in those words. And as a teenager, later on, I had many after-dinner conversations with my father to learn something about what I went through as a child. And it was from him that I heard many of the stories that we saw dramatized on the stage here. And the people I recognize, there are people all of them I know, the Hawaiian guy and from Hawaii, and the Kibe, the American-born but Japan-educated person. In fact, my mother was that, born in Florin, which is today a part of Sacramento. But in those days, they had segregated schools there, and my grandfather didn't like that, so she was sent to Japan for her education. So my American-born mother spoke English with a heavy Japanese accent and behaved in a very Japanese way. My father was born in Japan, in Yamanashi, also a province that's mentioned here in the play. But his mother died when he was very young, and my widower grandfather, my father's father, decided to come to America to seek opportunities, and he brought his two boys with him. My father was the younger, and he was educated and reared in San Francisco, and he felt very American. So my Japan-born father was fluent in both Japanese and English and behaved in a very American way. And I'm their child, so I'm very Japanese and American.
In those discussions with your dad, and later on, how did you come to terms with the injustice done to you and your family and to so many others?
It was a long, long time, many, many discussions. I was inspired by the civil rights movement at that time, and I took that and said, "Daddy, why didn't you do something about it? Why did you just go? I would have organized my friends at school and gone downtown to the federal building and demonstrated. Why did you not protest?" And he said, "Well, you probably would have done what you say you would have done, but I had to think about you, your mother, your brother, and your sister. They were pointing guns at us. Now, what do you think would happen to all of you if something happened to me?" And that painted a very real picture for me. But I was still that idealist. And so my father said, and I learned about American democracy from the man in our family that bore the anguish and the pain and the degradation and the whole torture of the imprisonment and the impoverishment the most. He said, "Despite everything, our American democracy is still the best form of government in the world because it's a people's government. And the people have done great things." And even it told me that President Roosevelt had done great things in the 30s when we had a crushing depression because of his power and his political connections and savvy. He was able to create jobs and pull people out of that. But he was also a fallible human being. And when a president makes a mistake, it's a great mistake. And we paid heavily for it. And one Sunday afternoon, he drove me downtown to the Adlai Stevenson for President campaign headquarters, and he showed me what it takes to make our democracy real. He said, "Look at these people. They're the ones that believe in the ideals of our democracy. And there I was with all these other passionately motivated people. And I'd heard Governor Stevenson's speeches on the radio, and they were inspiring.
Yes, they were.
And ever since then, I've been actively engaged, not only in the political process, but social justice
causes.
Yes,
we'll talk a little bit about that a bit later. Philip, how did the camps affect your family, and did the history of the camps inspire you to explore Japanese-American history?
Well, the story itself is based pretty closely on my mother's family, and they did end up, in fact, buying this hotel called the Europa Hotel in Stockton, in which my father, who is the character Bola, and Chiz is my mom, my father, in fact, set up a practice there. And one of my cousins is here also, who is my mom's sister. And I think the uncle set up a practice there. A pharmacy was set up on the bottom floor. And so, in fact, the story you saw is very much based on my own family, my mother's family. I was born subsequent to the camps, and in terms of its effect on me, I first became aware of it when I was quite young. This is post-war, and there would be people coming to the door occasionally, and they'd knock on the door, and my mother would answer it, and they would say, "Hi, I'm from the Daughters of the American Revolution, and we're here trying to raise monies." And I could never figure this out. My mother would go off on her. This is a very kind of, Japanese people don't do this, but she would go, "It's because of you that we are put in camps. How dare you come to my door?" And I would, as a little kid, and I'd be behind my mother going, "What the hell is going on?" That's when I first became aware of it. And then during the 60s, it was that time period when identity politics emerged. A lot of young Asian Americans went back home and asked their parents about this thing called the internment, and the story began to come out. And for me, it became a point of trying to figure out, as I was involved in creative arts, what was this thing inside of me that was a knot, that was kind of dark, and that I couldn't figure out, and that somehow kind of blocked me as I tried to move through life. And so I began to investigate this idea that the camps, in fact, created a kind of psychological scar, bruise on a whole people, and that is passed on subsequently to each subsequent generation. So for me, part of the journey was, one is to remember and try to remember as best as I could, or what happened before, and give it life. And then also to kind of explore the idea of how that psychic scar, was kind of put on me, and how that's affected my behavior, and allowed that to kind of inform all of my writing subsequent to that.
Tim, did the camps figure in your family history as well?
Well, I remember in eighth grade, and I grew up in Hawaii.
I was about to say, you grew up in Hawaii.
I did grow up in Hawaii, and I remember in eighth grade in our U.S. history books that there was only one sentence that referred to the camps, and then it moved on to the next event. So there was very little that was said in history books, and so that's why I think, very few people know today that the whole Japanese-American incarceration happened. I did go home and ask my mother in terms of what happened. And, my father, we were Chinese-American, born in Hawaii. So my father was actually stationed in Guadalcanal during World War II. So he was a vet. And my mother was actually a clerk at Pearl Harbor at that time. And what my mother remembers is the martial law that happened when Pearl Harbor was bombed, that everyone had to be home before dark.
George, you wrote a powerful article for the magazine Foreign Policy entitled, "At Least During the Internment Are Words I Thought I'd Never Utter." Can you tell us about that article?
Yes. We're living in turbulent times again now. We'd been sharing the story of our Japanese-American internment to draw the lesson from it, from past history, so that we won't repeat that ever again. And the chilling thing is, we are repeating that again and reaching a new low. Our families remained intact. There were some families where the father, if he were a Buddhist minister or a Japanese language teacher, was taken away and separated from the family. But the children were always with their mother. What's happening now is a new low. When people fleeing poverty and violence and horrific experiences flee desperately for their lives and come to our southern border, they have their children torn away from them and put in cages and then scattered all over the country, places like Minnesota, Michigan, New Jersey. And when the courts ordered them to be brought together, they're so incompetent that they can't put them together. And I was so moved by that event that I decided that we must relate that to the Japanese-American internment, that we do have a history of this sort of behavior, this unjust, unconstitutional behavior, and we must learn from it and teach it certainly to this generation, but also to generations yet to come by plays like Philip Kongotanda's many, many plays. We did a musical on it on Broadway, on the internment of Japanese Americans. People were a little kind of puzzled when we first told them about it, you know. But we wanted to humanize that story and have people understand that it's not just sentences in history books or civics books about civil liberties. It happened to human beings who had lives and sensed the loss and the pain. And also in camp, they found happiness and love and had children as well. There are people that were born in camp. And so I think it's very important that the lessons of the past be repeated, because we forget so easily. We must repeat it time and again so that this generation and future generations will prevent this sort of thing from happening again. I was encouraged when Trump signed that Muslim travel ban, his first executive order. We had learned, because thousands of people all across this country rushed to the airport to protest that. Attorneys volunteered their services at airports to foreigners coming into the country, and the Deputy Attorney General, Sally Yates, refused to defend that first executive order, and he had to do it two more times before it was finally semi-approved. And when the courts approved that, in the same action, they overturned the Korematsu judgment, which the Supreme Court had made, justifying and allowing the incarceration of Japanese Americans. History is full of ironies like this.
Philip, I'd like to ask you about a couple of words we hear in the Sisters Matsumoto: Buddha heads and kotonks. Can you tell us more? more about these terms and what they mean?
Well, my father is the character of Bola, and he always talked about how, kotonks are the ones from the mainland, and it's when a coconut falls on your head, it goes kotonk. And then if you are from Hawaii, you were a Buddha head. And it was more than just a term. It was actually a way of how you looked at life.
I have a question. How did that name Bola, where does that come from?
Well, actually, a cousin of mine from Hawaii used to get a haircut, and it looked like a bowl. And so he was called Bola, and I thought that was such a cool name. It wasn't my father's name.
Tim, for many years, you were artistic director of East West Players. What was your experience with Sisters Matsumoto when you were there, and how does it have new resonance in 2018?
Well, East West Players mission itself as an arts organization has a social justice mission. And so we are there to present stories about the Asian American experience. And Philip is one of our best storytellers of the Asian American experience. So at the time that we did Sisters Matsumoto, which was, I believe we did it in 2002, 2003, at East West Players at that time, that this was a great story to bring to the forefront, where while there was so much activism around the Japanese American internment at that time. Revisiting this play today by LA Theater Works, and again, I am so thankful that LA Theater Works is recording this play in perpetuity for others to learn from it. There is so much resonance with what George and Philip are saying today, with what's happening today with our government.
George, your record of social activism is remarkable. We were fortunate to record your performance in the play 8 by Dustin Lance Black, which dealt with California's notorious Proposition 8 defining marriage as between a man and a woman. When did it hit you that you could use your voice to speak out for same-sex marriage, equal rights, and so many other important issues?
I am a professional actor, and I passionately love what I do, but I could not be an actor if it were known that I was gay. And so I was closeted for most of my life. It wasn't until the California State Legislature did an extraordinary thing. It became the first state legislature to pass the Marriage Equality Bill in 2005. It was, Massachusetts had marriage equality, but it came through the state Supreme Court. Ours was the people's representatives voting and passing a marriage equality bill for gays. That bill needed one more signature, the signature of our governor, who happened to be Arnold Schwarzenegger, movie star. When he ran for governor, he ran by saying, "I'm from Hollywood, I've worked with gays and lesbians, some of my best friends are gays and lesbians." With that kind of campaign rhetoric, I thought he might think deeply on this and sign the bill. But his base is the Republican right wing. And when the bill landed on his desk, he vetoed it. And I was together with Brad then. We were raging, but we stayed silent. We turned on the TV that evening watching the late night news, and that news came on, and then it cut to a shot of young people pouring out onto Santa Monica Boulevard, venting their rage against Arnold Schwarzenegger. And we felt the same way, but we were at home comfortable. And so Brad and I talked, and we decided, yeah, now's the time. We have to talk. We have to be vocal. And I talked to the press for the first time as a gay man, and I blasted Arnold Schwarzenegger's veto. And from then on, I've been campaigning throughout the country.
That's the end of today's audiobook break. You've been listening to the Japanese American Civil Liberties Collection from LA Theater Works. It's one of the many excellent audio theater productions available at LA Theater Works. Visit latw.org for more information. Our music is All Our Yesterdays by Mark Niedvich. This has been Audiobook Break from Audiophile Magazine. Thanks for listening.